Mobile Bay, if you happen to pick us up and listen to us, I'm now hearing myself, and that's just very strange. Anyway, one of the things we were going to talk about was how things go in California, and usually how things end up being legislated across the rest of the United States. And we've talked about several issues, including anchor babies, California also wanting to offer illegal aliens driver's licenses, and many other things. But this week, California's single-payer health care plan has come into focus with the media. They're acting like it's a big surprise that California's single-payer health care plan would cost $400 billion per year. That's just for the state of California. You know, so written from a California perspective, this comes from townhall.com and Gary Benson. We have to give them a byline because we're going through and we're just doing an overview on what the media perspective is out in the wide open West. I'm broadcasting to you, of course, from southern Mississippi. So it always is something else to watch what happens in California, because when California goes, the rest of the country usually ends up following suit with. At least that's the general attitude that people legislating these things in California take. California, of course, being the most populous state in the United States and combating different social issues and ills, comes up with some solutions that probably would not apply across the rest of the country for, I guess, obvious reasons. But and now a glimpse into our possible future, courtesy of Deep Blue California. And when I say deep blue, I mean so blue that the Republican Party didn't even qualify a statewide candidate for the general election ballot in the 2016 Senate race. I mean so blue that the state's creaking, underperforming Obamacare expanded Medicaid program now has one-third of the entire population on its rolls, with state bookkeepers just fessing up to a $1.9 billion accounting error that camouflaged how deep in the hole it is. I mean, so blue that the state's long-term fiscal health is being weighted down by roughly $400 billion in rapidly growing unpaid-for promises known as unfunded liabilities, contributing to one of the worst bond ratings in the United States. I mean, so blue that Democrats' pet high-speed rail project is already tens of billions of dollars over budget and wildly behind schedule, partially due to astonishingly restrictive environmental regulations in California and a lawsuit-happy legal climate. I mean, so blue that in spite of all of the red flags flapping in these fiscal headwinds, a key committee in Sacramento, which is the state capital of California, recently advanced legislation to implement a single-payer, government-run healthcare system in the state. Now, describing that, a sweeping measure that would establish government-run universal health care in California cleared its first legislative hurdle last Wednesday as scores of supporters crammed into the state capitol to advocate for a single-payer system. The Senate Health Committee in California approved the measure on a 5-2 vote after a nearly three-hour hearing, but Democrats and Republicans alike signaled unease with the major question still unanswered in the legislation: how the program would be paid for. The bill, which is California SB 562, would establish a publicly run health care plan that would cover everyone living in the state of California, including those without legal immigration status. The proposal would drastically reduce the role of insurance companies. The state would pay for all medical expenses, including inpatient, outpatient, emergency services, dental, vision, mental health, and nursing home care. The measure says the program would be funded by broad-based revenue, but does not specify where that money would come from. So, healthcare for everyone, including illegal immigrants, paid for by mumble-mumble broad-based revenue, mumble, mumble. Details to come. Well, here's one brand new detail, a price tag, and here's the surprise. It would cost $400 billion to remake California's health insurance marketplace and create a publicly funded universal health care system, according to a state financial analysis released Monday. California would have to find an additional $200 billion per year, including in new tax revenues, to create a so-called single-payer system. The analysis by the Senate Appropriations Committee found this out in California. Now, the estimate assumes the state would retain the existing $200 billion in local, state, and federal funding it currently receives to offset the total $400 billion price tag. Steep projected costs have derailed efforts over the past two decades, 20 years, to establish such a healthcare system in the state of California. The cost is higher than the $180 billion in proposed general fund and special fund spending for the budget year, which begins July 1st. Now, California employers currently spend between $100 billion to $150 billion per year, which could be available to help offset total costs, according to the analysis. Now, under that scenario, total new spending to implement the system would be between $50 billion and $100 billion per year. The new system would more than double the cost of California's already swollen annual budget, with no specific pay-fors in the offing. Even if you assume that employers would dump all of their employees into the government system, how would that prospect go over with voters? And the state could magically repurpose all of those dollars to fund the new scheme. California would still be $50 to $100 billion short every single year. This would require massive across-the-board economy and job-crushing tax increases on everybody, including middle-income and working-class earners. In other words, despite the Democrats' leading gubernatorial contender actively campaigning on this ridiculous fantasy, California's single-payer dreams are likely to go the way of Vermont's. Let's have a little flashback to 2014. You know, for decades, liberal activists yearned for a European-style single-payer health system that they argued would lead to more affordable, efficient, and comprehensive medical coverage for all citizens. When Vermont, 4 years ago, 2010, enacted a landmark bill to establish the nation's first single-payer health care system, they saw their long-sought dream about to be fulfilled. But reality hit. In 2014, Governor Peter Shumlin released a financial report that showed the cost of the program would nearly double the size of the state of Vermont's budget in the first year alone and require large tax increases for residents and businesses. Mr. Shumlin, a Democrat and longtime single-payer advocate, said he would not seek funding for the law, effectively tabling the program, which was called Green Mountain Care. Government healthcare advocates remain undeterred, waving off the Veterans Administration disgrace as an overblown Republican attack on an underfunded program, which was a false accusation, and insisting that a nationwide federal system would be more feasible than state-level experiments. Now, they argue that the national government would wield more power to negotiate lower prices for services and drugs, setting aside the inhibited medical innovation and state-mandated rationing that a socialized system would inflict. A nationwide single-payer regime would also cost a fortune, necessitating much higher taxes across many income brackets. Many of the European nations, often cited by leftists as models for the United States, impose staggeringly high payroll taxes on their citizens, with double-digit consumption taxes like value-added taxes or VATs piled on top. Much, much higher taxes for much more government, while relying on the United States military to provide a backstop on defense in Europe. Oh, and another number of those social democracy Euro paradises are moving back towards private coverage as their public systems falter. Scott Atlas, a medical doctor and senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, highlighted the still going ongoing phenomenon in Europe in 2014. About 6 million British citizens buy private health insurance, and about 250,000 choose to pay for private treatment out of pocket each year, although the National Health Service's insurance costs $3,500 annually for every British man, woman, and child. The socialized medicine model is struggling elsewhere in Europe as well. Even in Sweden, often heralded as the paradigm of a successful welfare state, months-long wait times for treatment, routinely available in the United States, have been widely documented. To fix the problem, the Swedish government has aggressively introduced private market forces into healthcare to improve access, quality, and choices. Municipal governments have increased spending on private care contracts by 50% in the past 10 years. Swedish primary care clinics and nursing facilities are increasingly run by the private sector or receive substantial public funding, though Swedish economist Per Bylund calculates that the average Swedish family already pays nearly $20,000 annually in taxes toward health care. About 12% of working adults bought private insurance in 2013, a number that's increased by 67% over the past 5 years. So since 2008, the cost has increased by 67%. And we're not even dealing with current numbers here, folks, because this is all reporting that's going back now 4 years. According to the trade organization Insurance Sweden, all of those numbers were current in 2014. Almost 600,000 Swedes now use private insurance, though they are guaranteed public health care. Now, Mr. Atlas and other single-payer critics have also documented how, despite its flaws and high costs, the United States healthcare system consistently delivers significantly superior cancer survival rates, far greater access to care, including new treatments and technology, and much shorter wait times for care than more government-heavy models provide. This data is from 2009, but Mr. Atlas says its key trends and results remain in the public, an American public system's favor as of today. You have to excuse me, folks, I didn't write this. He is also emerging as a savage critic of a World Health Organization study published in the year 2000, which is 16 years ago, which is often cited in critiques of the American system and in support of increased government intervention. That study's findings placed greater weight on equality than actual healthcare outcomes and used methodological sleight of hand to distort the quality of American care. For instance, Mr. Atlas and others also expose how one seemingly ubiquitous and bogus talking point was concocted. He says the World Health Organization ranked the United States 42nd in life expectancy. In their book, The Business of Health, Robert L. Osfeld and John E. Snyder of the University of Iowa demonstrated that this finding was a gross misrepresentation. World Health Organization actually included immediate deaths from murder or fatal high-speed motor vehicle accidents in their assessment, as if an ideal healthcare system could turn back time to undo car crashes and prevent homicides. Osfeld and Schneider did their own life expectancy calculations using nations of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or the OECD. Now, with fatal car crashes and murders included, the United States ranked 19 out of 29 in life expectancy. With both of those removed, the United States had the world's best life expectancy numbers. So, if you include homicides and instant death car wrecks in the statistics, neither of which are reflections on the efficiency or effectiveness of a healthcare system, the U.S. ranks 19th in the OECD life expectancy rank. That looks bad. You eliminate those two factors, however, and the United States shoots up to the top of the heap. Another data point that's frequently tossed about as an indictment of the U.S. healthcare system is our high infant mortality rate. When you dig into the numbers, America fares so poorly in this category because, well, we count dead babies differently than they do in other places. In most developed nations, premature births are recorded in the statistics as miscarriages or stillbirths. The lives that doctors in those places don't attempt to save are never recorded as live births. Many countries don't try to save infants born prematurely or with severe birth defects. United States doctors go to extraordinary lengths to give these infants a chance at life. Such best efforts often fail, and the death becomes a misleading statistic. When the Centers for Disease Control excluded births before 24 weeks of gestation, the American infant mortality rate fell from 6.1 infant deaths per 1,000 live births to 4.2, a number comparable to the rest of the developed world's figures. Put bluntly, American doctors try harder to save more babies, and doctors in other countries don't tally certain births as live births the way we do, and our statistics suffer because of our moral choice to prioritize attempting to save these extremely vulnerable lives. Now, the bottom line is, if you're craving a fair system that stifles innovation, rations care, limits access, creates lengthy wait lists for basic medical services, and has worse survival rates for serious conditions like cancer, single payer is the way forward if you're using European models. And even if that all sounds acceptable to you, looking at California, the rest of America, good luck paying for it. You know, I mean, that's it's pretty much the take that that they have there. And I mean, that's just a little bit outrageous. If you are on the side of single coverage, you know, single payer coverage in the United States, it's something that has to be looked at, is how it's going to be paid for. Now, California's plan is probably not the best plan for the rest of the United States to make a model after, and we're going to see how this is going to go with the bill actually having been passed in California, and how they're going to actually try and where they're going to try to appropriately have to raise taxes, because that's really all you could do to generate revenue on a state level to pay for an extra $150 to $200 billion a year. And the state of California simply isn't going to be able to afford to spend $150 to $200 billion a year that it doesn't have coming in for very long before, you know, the entire state is going to end up paying for its single-payer healthcare system and find itself in default along with its nationwide worst bond rating. People will be flocking out of California if they're going to provide a startup business to support their family. They're going to want to look elsewhere because the tax rates for the single-payer healthcare system are just going to be outrageous. I think you're also going to see, once this legislation is implemented in California, at least on a one-and-done attempt, you're going to see a mass exodus of people who are making nominal incomes and do not want to have the healthcare costs taken out of their spending budget for their lifestyle. And they may end up moving to other places across the United States where they can perform their job duties either for their company, if it's a nationwide corporation that has offices in many states. People will be expressly creating job transfer requests with their human resources department. That's probably going to be a nightmare. So I feel the pain of all of the folks in California who will be looking for the human resources director to see if they could put in and find a job in Oregon or somewhere. It's just very, very bizarre. And so as California goes the rest of the United States. Now, personally, I can say that without any hesitation, I am one of those people who supports the concept of creating a single payer healthcare system in the United States. I don't think that the Obamacare Affordable Health Care Act reform in its current state, or even in a reformulated state as it is, had been proposed, passed through the House of Representatives here in the United States, is an acceptable form of single payer health insurance. It's not to be confused with single payer health insurance either. The Affordable Care Act was devised to attempt to provide an entry into the healthcare marketplace for more Americans who could not afford health insurance. And if you lived in one of the 14 states that did not expand their Medicaid coverage under the Affordable Care Act, you probably saw something along the lines of, you are ineligible for Obamacare entry because you made more money than you did the year before when you qualified for the tax credit on the Obamacare schedule, which allowed you to purchase health care at an affordable rate. There have been a lot of people shaking their heads, rolling their eyes, wondering where or if they were even going to have health care in the year 2017. And things don't look any better for 2018. And I don't think that the House of Representatives is going to be able to meet in the middle with the Senate if the Senate passes the reforms to the Affordable Care Act in any way, shape, or form, and have anything ready for launch when the Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act renews its enrollment period beginning in October of 2017. People will have, you know, up to the beginning of January, I think it's January or February 15th of 2018, to be enrolled in the open enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act, which begins in October of 2017. So it's looking less and less likely that there's actually going to be anything that's passed by the House, which it already has, but also passed by the Senate. And then differences between the House bill and the Senate bill, if passed, have to go into committee meetings, and the differences have to either be accepted or the thing is going to end up tabled and it's not going to make it to the president's desk. So I'm not going to be taking any bets here on Voice of the People Radio as to whether or not the Senate is going to eventually pass the reformed Affordable Care Act legislation. That is an argument that is going to go on for weeks and perhaps even months as we look down the barrel of the summer vacation season. Of course, Congress continues working while your children are out of school and you're dealing with the family vacations and all of that fun stuff. And hardly anybody is really going to be keeping their eyes on things like C-SPAN when you have your kids at the hotel and you want to make sure that they're taking their water wings out so that there isn't any kind of an accident. You're more likely to see a lot of provisions being debated on the Affordable Care Act reform for the Senate committees during the off hours where nobody's really going to be paying attention to it. And we will be lucky if we even see any kind of announcement where the thing is going to be headed to a vote on the Senate floor before all of the kids in the United States end up coming off of their summer vacation and end up going back to school. Needless to say, whether or not it even is passed before the open enrollment period begins for the next round of what has affectionately been called Obamacare, which is actually the Affordable Care Act legislation. So that was my reason for bringing in this article about what's been going on, what's been passed on in California. Everybody in California is going to be operating on the assumption that the rest of the United States is going to state by state model a single-payer health care plan after the one that's in California, because after all, California has the larger population. California has the wisdom and foresight to come up with an effective and workable solution that would then apply to Hawaii and the other, you know, 48 states beyond there. You know, if I were somebody that lived in Alaska or Hawaii, and I, you know, knew that closest neighbors, and I'm not saying anything disrespectful to anybody in the state of Washington or the state of Oregon. It's just they kind of get ignored over there on the West Coast. And it looks like California is again going to try to dictate some kind of policy and reform and legislation, expecting the rest of the United States to rapidly follow suit. You know, everything isn't the same in a healthcare system, depending entirely on your population and what your demographics are. And so you are going to have a big difference in the way healthcare works in a state like North Carolina versus a state like California, a state like New Hampshire, or as was mentioned in that article earlier, the state of Vermont, which attempted to pass its own single-payer health coverage and found out that it would double the size of the state of Vermont's entire budget. All of the money that the people of Vermont would be spending on everything else did not add up to what it would cost for a little tiny state, population-wise, like Vermont, to be able to run a single-payer European-model healthcare plan. Now, the big thing about this and why I'm an open advocate for single-payer healthcare coverage in the United States is statistically looking at the way our population is going to age over the next 25 years. We need a safety net in the United States, in my own personal opinion, for those who are reliant completely on the existing Medicaid system, for folks who will be 65 and older, 68 and older, 70 and older, 72 and older, up to 73 and older. I don't think that Social Security has begun limiting anyone's retirement age at 74 or 75 just yet, but we're looking at a stair step with the retirement ages where folks will be able to retire to be able to collect whatever their Social Security benefits are. And so over the course of the next 20 to 25 years, you're going to have a substantial number of folks in the U.S. population, meaning more than 25%, one quarter of the population, are going to be of retirement age or older. And, you know, to use just a little more leeway there, it also means that the way women outlive men, it's just a general given with our life expectancies, you are also going to end up with a large number of, you know, single or widowed little old ladies, and we love little old ladies that listen to us here on Voice of the People. Don't get me wrong when I'm saying it. It's not said with any malice whatsoever. I just want you to all sit there and think about your grandmother or your great-grandmother, and that in the next 10 or 15 years, great-grandma is going to be asked to take less and less out of a healthcare system and while needing more and more personal care. You know, so that's why I'm a personal advocate for a single-payer healthcare system in the country, because, you know, it's just part of the human physiology. It's something we haven't figured out with molecular biological science to be able to increase the human lifespan to 120 years so we don't have to worry about anything like this. And as a population, I mean, we should look at what's been going on with Japan, because Japan is in the situation the United States will find itself in the next 10 to 20 years. So Japan has the largest number of people 65 and older in the world, in the Western civilized world. So we should take a look, and perhaps California will take a look and see, you know, how things have been modeled for the Japanese with a longer life expectancy, because you really don't want grandma to end up getting bad health care. It's just that simple. You know, would you do it to your grandmother? No. So why would you want to do it to somebody else's grandmother just because they live in another state and there happen to be more grandmas in that state? You know, statistically speaking, you probably have a larger number of grandparents and great-grandparents living in places that are now retirement states like Florida and Arizona, New Mexico, and, of course, Southern California. So taking a look down the short term road of how the state of California is going to end up having to spend $400 billion a year for its single payer health care system if it's put in place. You know, and that's a big thing. If the government at the state level decides not to increase taxes, or Governor Jerry Brown out in California, who incidentally is past 65 years of age, so he's in that golden age bracket that we're talking about, incidentally decides that the state of California really can't afford to spend that $50 to $200 billion extra a year, or cannot afford to pull out all the stops and repurpose the existing budget because they simply don't have enough time to find out how to do it. You know, not that there's a shortage of accountants in California. I'm sure they could put together a brain trust to figure that whole thing out, but are they really going to be successful with it? You know, I mean, it's just a crazy thing. If the rest of the United States had the unfunded liabilities that the state of California had, the rest of the United States would have one of the worst bond ratings in the world. You know, the United States, you know, all states inclusive, California has one of the worst bond ratings in the United States. So what is going to be done to keep people from moving out of California once there's a single payer health care plan put into place? You know, because it's passed, it's out there, it's waiting. It's going to go to Governor Brown's desk. So somebody like me, I'm going to be sitting here waiting to find out how the state's going to pay for it. I mean, that's a lot of money, folks, you know, $400 billion in already unpaid for things that are unfunded liabilities on the California budget. And you're matching that with a single payer health care system for the state of California that's going to pretty much be the, you know, the same. So when you look at that, you're forced to admit using math that the state of California is like $800 billion behind the curve. So $800 billion a year would take care of the single payer health care system in California and everything else that they can't pay for right now. They're, you know, they're in their tens of billions of dollars over budget and wildly behind schedule with the high speed rail project, which is supposed to increase the ability of people to get from one place to another in the state of California, to be able to, let's say, commute, you know, from Northern California to Southern California on a high-speed train, the way a lot of people take a train from upstate New York into Manhattan to be able to go to work. Well, California, in their wisdom, has been projecting that they're going to be able to build this high-speed rail project and have it be like the super-fast trains that are in Japan, except that it's not on schedule, and it's tens of billions of dollars over budget. And is it going to be put on the back burner because the state's looking for money to pay for this $50 to $200 billion shortfall in cash to pay for this single-payer healthcare system? And so goes the rest of America. So far, we really haven't seen the rest of the United States chomping at the bit to do what California did last year in allowing undocumented illegal workers, you know, to get a California's driver's license so that the California Highway Patrol or the local police will be able to identify them, you know, and actually say, okay, well, this is who I am. This is where I live, but I also live in a sanctuary city. So even though you're only pulling me over for having a taillight out on my car, which I 99% of the time don't have insurance for, you're not going to be able to have the immigration and customs enforcement agents come arrest me, even though I'm an undocumented migrant worker living at this address, which is on my driver's license in the state of California. Ha ha. And that's about the result that the state of California achieved with encouraging undocumented workers to be able to go get a driver's license. It doesn't mean that there's any fewer people out there driving illegally or driving without insurance, and that causes the cost of automobile insurance to go up, which means that you have less people in California actually driving because they can't afford the insurance. It's not that they couldn't afford the car. You know, there's a common misconception there that I can't afford the car, so that's why I'm taking the bus, or I'm out in San Francisco and I'm taking the BART, I'm taking the Bay Area Rapid Transit back and forth to work. It's not that the person can't afford their job if they work at Google, okay, and they're taking the train. It's because the insurance rates are so astronomically high that it's just not logical for them to not take the public transportation across the bay. One way or the other, you know, or across the city. It's just not economical for these people to be paying the outrageous amounts of insurance for their car because of the number of uninsured motorists and how much coverage costs for you to have uninsured motorist coverage on your car and full, you know, collision coverage, fire, theft, all that good stuff on your car, which you've worked hard to pay for, you know, at your job, making your money, you know, living in your place. Because the state of California has the quite simple problem of what to do about all of the undocumented people that are there. And really, they're not contributing to the baseline of the California economy. The employment taxes aren't there. They're not going to surface anytime soon. If the person is working under the table, nothing's being taken out for any kind of federal program for Social Security. There is no FICA withholding. There's nothing taken out for Medicare. So, you know, single-payer health care coverage, you got people working illegally or under the table in California who are not paying. However, they are, according to the state law as it has passed, the California legislature and the California Senate legislature at the moment, those undocumented workers who are technically paying zero into this single-payer healthcare system are going to be receiving the same benefits as a person who has a six-figure income from working out at Google, who ends up having to take the train and the bus because they don't want to pay the excess on their vehicle, and they don't want to take the risk of, you know, what's going to happen if they get hit by somebody that's not covered. That's, you know, they're driving a car. It might be in, and also it might be in someone else's name. It's how easy is it for you to register a vehicle as a vehicle owner if you're an undocumented alien worker in California? How much do you want to bet that most of these vehicle registrations belong to legal family members? You know, and yet the vehicle is being used by an uncle or a nephew or a cousin to travel uninsured along the roads all across the great state of California, much to the chagrin of everyone else who's having to pay excessive, exorbitant amounts for their auto insurance because those people were not influenced enough and told that, hey, you know, in order to have a driver's license, you must insure your vehicle. Didn't happen. Just flatly didn't happen. Now, other states like Arizona, if you do not pay your insurance for your vehicle, the Bureau of Motor Vehicles is notified by your insurance carrier and your license is immediately suspended in the system, so that if you are pulled over and you have to have a taillight out, they're going to say, well, your license has been suspended for the last 30 days because you didn't pay for your insurance. You know, California having to deal with a system like that might have had a better chance of getting undocumented immigrants to actually go ahead and do something about their undocumented status, but above and beyond that, do something about it, insuring the vehicles. You know, so it's a really crazy situation out there. You know, and if you happen to live in the state of California, none of what I'm saying is meant to try to offend you personally. It's just is what it is. The rest of the country looks at it and says, you know, oh my God, they're going to want us to model after this. We've learned a big lesson from it in the past 50 years with all of California's environmental laws, all of California's emissions testings. We've seen the models go into other states. Of course, those other states use those vehicle emissions testings and pollution law controls to their benefit in order to make their motorists have to go pay exorbitant fees, their Bureau of Motor Vehicles, to test for atmospheric pollutants while not providing any form of remediation for the thing, and just telling the vehicle owner, sorry, but you're going to have some work done or have the engine replaced on your car because your exhaust system failed and you don't match up with the pollution control standards, where we're trying to match up our pollution control standards to those of California. A lot of those schemes have come and gone in some states. They've fallen by the wayside because it was seen as just another racket for such state to line their pockets at the expense of the motorists while doing absolutely nothing to prevent further pollution to the environment. Also inconveniencing thousands of people, having their boss angry at them because they have to go out and they have to have this emissions test done, and it has to be done within the business hours of the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, etc. and so forth. Huge inconvenience. Did it really do anything to cut down on the amount of greenhouse gases and everything that people have been afflicted with and their after effects? No, it has not. Such is the way that a national driver's license program will probably not pass because of what has gone on with the undocumented workers in California, such as the way that, you know, transportation and infrastructure repair will have to be modeled into future budget considerations by the Trump administration because they want to spend over $1 trillion. Well, where's the money going to come from in a state like California? You know, which, well, they didn't vote for President Trump, but they would have to pay their fair share for the federal funding that they would receive under Transportation Recovery and Repair Act. And if they're already $400 in the hole with unpaid for obligations and they're staring down the barrel of $50 to $150 billion for a single-payer health care plan system in California, what are the odds that the state of California is going to be able to come up with any money to match anything on any public-private enterprise that President Trump may propose in the future to be able to improve the quality of roads and bridges out in California? It would just end up being another one of the state's things on the list of unfunded liabilities. And the state of California would be expecting the federal government to kick out the funding for the road and infrastructure rebuilding program that President Trump has already proposed in order to get our road and rail system and our transportation in general out of the D-plus grade status that it received from the National Engineers a few months ago and on its way to recovery, hopefully, to an A-plus system within my lifetime. Am I going to bet on that, folks? I don't think so. But is it going to be necessary? Yes, because you also don't want grandma to drive under a bridge in Toledo, Ohio, and be killed by a falling chunk of concrete where the bridge infrastructure was not inspected properly and there was no maintenance done on it. And so there was a tragic accident with grandma while she was driving down to the grocery store in her Prius. Don't want to see it happen. That's why the president proposed the infrastructure and proposed the possibility of public-private ventures with federal tax money. Is that tax money going to do the state of California any good? Not when they're in the hole that they're in. And, you know, not to be apolitical, but when you look at the reality of the situation, how are these things being voted in a state like California? It is because of the political climate and because they have a Democratic majority in their state house and in their state senate. Yeah, you know, and it's just not fiscally responsible. California may have the largest budget shortfall in the United States because it has the largest population, but it also has the least amount of fiscal responsibility built into things like this law that they passed. You know, so I'm hoping that, you know, things will come together. There'll be some lessons to be learned from this, but it just is very scary when you see the things that the state of California puts out there, knowing that they fully expect, you know, the other 49 states to follow suit and do as they do because they're the big kid on the block. You know, it is just really bizarre. You know, the cost for remaking California's health insurance marketplace and create a publicly funded universal healthcare system, according to their own state financial analysis, is $400 billion for that single-payer system. So we should keep that in mind as we talk into the future, folks, about what the pros and cons are for a single-payer healthcare system here in the United States. Of course, the person running in the 2016 presidential primaries, Democratic senator, independent senator from the state of Vermont, which passed the single healthcare payer, single payer healthcare system in 2010, Senator Bernie Sanders was the only major candidate who was actually advocating a single payer healthcare system and believed that the single payer healthcare system could be passed nationwide by your state representatives and your state senates. But the only big question, and it's the 300-pound gorilla in the room, is how in the heck is everybody supposed to be able to pay for it? And I personally think that the way the European Union has gone over the last 25 years with the value-added taxes is the way that the United States eventually is going to concede economically to having to formulate a value-added tax so that when you buy a piece of merchandise, whether you're doing so over the internet that's coming to you from another state, or you're doing it by mail order, or you're driving there and you're picking it up yourself, that the tax is going to be included like a sales tax on whatever item it is. And that's how we're going to end up having to pay for a single-payer healthcare system in the United States. Personally, I also think that it's unavoidable due to our aging population that we will have a single-payer healthcare system in the United States, whether we want one or not, because given the statistics and the growing age of our population and the segment of our population that is aging, it is very unrealistic for us to look at an 18 to 26-year-old kid who's just graduating from college and who's saddled with hundreds of thousands of dollars in student debt to be able to actually go out into the marketplace and work under a system where gradually they would be taking home 15 cents of every dollar that they make if the nationwide pay scale and everything was adjusted to pay for something like this, as if the rest of the United States was California. And I'm pretty sure that those kids would look at it and say, well, what's the point of going to work if I'm going to be making 15 cents out of every dollar that I'm in here working for? I either have to be crazy, or I have to really, really love my job and nobody else wants to do it but me in order for me to only be compensated with 15 cents out of that dollar and have 85 cents of every dollar that I make from my workplace going into taxes to support the current system. So that's why the system has to be changed, folks. Because, you know, your grandkids, my grandkids, they're not going to want to take a 9-to-5, 40-hour